The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
Hello, it's The Takeaway for Thursday, October 13th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And from bombastic storyteller Longshot to GOP favorite to scandal-whipped celebrity to a desperate man now suddenly caught in his very memorable web of personal history with women, Shakespeare couldn't even write that. It's the Trump saga, and following the release of a tape from Access Hollywood, which shows Donald Trump casually discussing the liberties he likes to take with strange women because he's so famous. Now, over the last 24 hours, numerous women have come forward alleging that Trump was not simply bragging in some locker room. Remember when in the last debate, Anderson Cooper asked Trump about the comments he made on the Access Hollywood tape?
Are you saying that what you said on that bus 11 years ago, that you did not actually kiss women without consent or grope women without consent?
I have great respect for women. Nobody has more respect for women than I do.
So for the record, you're saying you never did that?
I said things that, frankly, you hear these things are said. And I was embarrassed by it, but I have tremendous respect for women.
Have you ever done those things?
And women have respect for me. And I will tell you, no, I have not.
Well, yesterday, the New York Times reported that two women had been subjected to unwanted advances by Donald Trump. Jessica Leeds was sitting next to Trump on a flight to New York in the 1980s.
He started encroaching on my space. And I hesitate to use this expression, but I'm going to. And that is, he was like an octopus. It was like he had six arms. He was all over the place. And if he had stuck with the upper part of the body, I might not have gotten that upset. But it's when he started putting his hand up my skirt. And that was it.
Several more women have come forth, including Temple Taggart, who was Miss Utah in 1997. Who told the Today Show about her encounter with Trump.
And it was at that time where he turned to me and embraced me and gave me a kiss on the lips. And I remember being shocked. I don't want to get emotional, but yeah, it's really hard because you think of sending your little daughter out there, with men like that, that think like that.
Donald Trump says all of these allegations are a total fabrication. What Trump has started might not end for him in the White House, and we will try to dissect the forensics in all of this. But more importantly, we will look at the agony of voters all over the country. In less than a week, a stampede of top Utah Republicans have abandoned support for Donald Trump in the wake of his leaked tapes. Now Trump and Secretary Hillary Clinton are locked in a virtual tie in Utah, according to one recent poll, at around 26%. But in a close third is a relatively unknown independent contender who has emerged from the so-called Never Trump camp, an independent named Evan McMullen, a Mormon, a BYU graduate, and former CIA operative, polling just a few percentage points behind the embattled Republican nominee. We'll hear from McMullen himself later this hour. But first, to understand what exactly is motivating Utah voters, we turn to Lisa Riley Roach, political reporter for Deseret News.
I think a lot of Utahns have been uncomfortable with their choices at the top of the ticket for a long time. Both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are not popular in Utah. Both finished very, very far behind the other contenders in our March caucus vote. I think because Utah is reliably Republican, we haven't voted for a Democrat for president in this state since 1964. Some Republicans were starting to come around. The argument used was that the Supreme Court hung in the balance, and if they wanted to see like-minded conservatives on the court as opposed to more liberal justices, they needed to vote for the Republican. There's a lot of support here for Donald Trump's running mate, Indiana Governor Mike Pence.
When did the feeling begin, okay, the court is an issue, and Mike Pence, that really sort of puts me in the Trump column?
That's been a push from some in the party from around the time of the even before the convention.
Mm-hmm.
As I'm sure you know, at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, Utah helped lead what would have been a protest vote against Trump, our Senator Mike Lee, who is a close friend of Texas Senator Ted Cruz, tried to force a vote that probably would have just been nothing more than embarrassing to Trump at the convention. But our senior senator, Orrin Hatch, has very much pushed this idea of a Supreme Court, as well as other Republicans here. It's kind of uncharted territory for Republicans not to automatically get behind their nominee, and I think it's been a hard decision. And of course, it became an almost impossible decision for many with the release of the video with Trump's comments. That made it impossible for a number of Republicans here to continue to even say they would vote for Trump.
Utahns are predisposed to not vote Democratic under any circumstances, but Hillary Clinton is even offensive given that, right?
Well, offensive isn't the word I would use. She's just never been popular here.
Right.
Her husband, Bill Clinton, as president, was not popular. You know, he came in third place in 1992 behind an independent candidate, Ross Perot. He declared a national monument in the southern portion of the state and upset a lot of Utahns. It's tough. I mean, neither candidate has been that popular, frankly, nationwide, but that was especially pronounced here. You know, Bernie Sanders got over 80% of the vote in the Democratic caucus and a huge turnout, a lot of enthusiasm for him here.
Now it seems they have permission to vote for Evan McMullen, who's a third option, who's running very strongly in Utah. Tell me a little bit about Evan McMullen.
Now, Evan McMullen is a Utah native. He is Mormon. He has strong credentials in terms of his experience for a lot of Utahns, having served in the CIA, more recently on the Hill with House Republicans. He's a new face to all of us here in Utah, I think. We didn't know anything about him until he stepped up as a potential candidate. So it was a big surprise, and he's really pushing hard here in Utah, as well as some of the other western states that have large blocks of Mormon voters.
Do you know where he's on the ballot?
He's on the ballot only in 11 states, but he is a potential write-in candidate in others, bringing the total up. His campaign hopes to 43 by Election Day.
Lisa Riley Roach is a politics reporter with the Deseret News. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So who is this fellow, Evan McMullen, looking to grab Utah's six electoral votes in the chaos and personal agony of voters and become the first independent candidate to win any electoral vote since 1968, when Alabama Governor George Wallace won five states? Independent presidential candidate Evan McMullen joins me now. Evan, welcome to The Takeaway.
Great to be with you.
Isn't that great in America? A gentlemanly fellow who speaks nicely to women trying to make history.
It shouldn't be so noteworthy.
What is the opportunity that you have here, and when did you discover it was really centered in Utah?
Well, I knew even before I got into the race that the Mountain West in general, Utah obviously being part of that, was the key. Why? Because the Mountain West rejected Donald Trump so strongly in the primaries. They also rejected Hillary Clinton, by the way. There's a sense out here that this country just deserves better leadership. They're rejecting both of these two major party candidates and looking for something better. And I think what we've learned about Donald Trump in the past week or so has validated what I and my running mate Mindy Finn have said about Trump for a year now. But I had said early on that he was a chauvinist, that he was abusive towards women. He's proven that he has bragged about sexual assault and claimed that that's what he does. You know, we have, of course, women stepping forward in the past 24 hours saying that he not only bragged about doing that, but he did it to them. None of this should be a surprise. It's no surprise to me. I'm just glad that finally people are seeing what I saw and what Mindy saw for so long. And we're offering the American people a vision for America that's unifying. We believe it's time in America to rededicate ourselves to some of the foundational, timeless truths upon which this country was founded. The idea that all men and women were created equal. You know, I'll just say that I find it so unfortunate that here we are in 2016, and I feel that one of the main things I have to say out there as I'm campaigning is make the case that we're all created equal. And I have to do that because Donald Trump has carried out such an assault on that truth.
What did you play at BYU, basketball or football?
I wasn't an athlete at BYU. I spent most of my time studying, actually. I don't know if that made its way into my bio. But no, my goal at BYU was to work for the CIA, and I spent most of my time studying very, very hard so that that would happen.
So if you were to win, what's your next play? I mean, do you join a party? Do you do like a Bernie Sanders, or do you do a Lieberman?
If I were to win, I would evaluate that based on what I thought was best for the country. But the way I see it now is that I would likely remain independent. I'm a conservative. I've always been a conservative as an adult. But I do believe that I would be a more effective president as an independent than I would being beholden to either party at this point. But I believe that we need to open up the political process at this point. The leaders that we're getting from both major parties are so terrible. They don't have the courage to stand up for what's right.
All right. So how over the next 4 years, because that's really going to be the story over the next 4 years, no matter who gets elected. And I think at this point it's becoming clearer and clearer. The next 4 years are about realignment. How are you going to be a part of that realignment on the GOP or conservative side?
You know, whether we win or lose, and, you know, our odds for winning, they're tough. And we've been transparent about that since day one. It's not impossible, especially in this campaign where you can catch fire in days. And we've shown that over the past couple of days. So, you know, we're still working hard. But, you know, if we are not, for example, elected, or if whether we are or we're not, I believe it's time in this country for a new conservative movement. This conservative movement must rededicate itself to the truth that we are all created equal and to the cause of individual liberty. The Republicans have lost their way on both those counts, and we see that on display in this election, where we have a racist Republican nominee who some Republicans are rejecting, but not all of them. We have a nominee who believes that men are superior to women. At least he treats them that way. We have a nominee who I don't believes in individual liberty. You see that evidenced by his stop and frisk policy, as well as others.
Evan McMullen is independent presidential candidate polling very well in the state of Utah. Thanks so much.
Yep, thank you.
Then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. Or the times they are a-changing.
He does have an enormous body of work. Bob Dylan won the Nobel Prize for Literature today. And speaking of Dylan's lyrics, the times are a-changing for Wells Fargo, the bank. On Wednesday afternoon, Wells Fargo announced that co-chairman and chief executive John Stumpf would be stepping down from the bank in response to the bank's sales tactics scandal, which resulted in the opening of as many as 2 million accounts without customers' knowledge. Already the board had decided it would claw back $41 million from Stump, but it's uncertain whether he will face any future punishment now that he has departed the company. President and Chief Operating Officer Timothy Sloan will assume Stump's role. Sheila Kohatkar is staff writer at The New Yorker, covering the unexpected announcement of Stump's resignation.
I think a lot of people will be heartened to see that something big has happened. Somebody has lost their job. However, I don't think it really solves the bank's problems because, you know, we know there are a number of investigations going on. The Department of Justice is investigating. They are appointing someone who's been at the bank for more than 20 years, Sloan, to take over. So although he is not from the retail banking division, Mr. Sloan does not represent sort of a fresh new face in the corridors of the bank. And, you know, there's still a lot of unanswered questions. Who knew what? How much did the executives know about what these lower level employees were doing, opening these unauthorized accounts? Were they being pressured to do it? Were they punished for trying to complain about it? These are all things that the bank is still going to need to answer for.
I think this whole strategy of opening ghost accounts and having them charge fees to people who don't look at those statements closely. This is the zone that I think is really frightening in the financial industry right now, because there's so much fine print. I mean, Charles Schwab could be doing this. Vanguard could be doing this. I mean, any number of people could be doing this. How easy is it? Apparently very easy to flick on switches that mean suddenly you have a different account.
Well, I think it's I think we're going to see more scandals like this in the future. I mean, really, after the financial crisis and the Dodd-Frank reform legislation was passed, a lot of banks had to sort of pull back on riskier activities that they were engaged in to make money, like trading.
Yeah.
So many banks have kind of turned instead to consumers as a way to make money. And we've seen a number of stories over the last few years about fees. You know, suddenly all these new fees pop up. It sort of reminds me of the airline industry, where now they're charging for things they never used to charge for. Overdraft fees have gone up. A lot of sort of harsh penalties for lower income bank customers who, you know, don't have a high balance in their account. So that kind of thing has happened. I think it's actually really easy to open an account in someone else's name. I mean, we've seen now a lot of firsthand accounts of Wells Fargo employees over the last few weeks. And it sounds like, yes, it was extremely easy. Their colleagues could see that they were doing it. And as one sort of bank executive told me when I was reporting on this, you know, if you give people incentives to open accounts, they're going to open accounts. I mean, it's a pretty simple equation.
If banking is shifting to this fee world, the regulations are different, right? I mean, there aren't protections that – I mean, I'm trying to imagine a regulation that would prevent me from having an account open in my name that I didn't, like, sign or put some blood in a little vial or something. You know what I mean?
Well, I think it is very clearly a fraudulent thing to do,
yeah,
to open an account on behalf of a customer who has not requested it. But this is the reason that Senator Elizabeth Warren, who has really had a very prominent voice in this whole thing, that's the reason that she argued for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And that is the reason that that bureau kind of came into being. She sort of said, listen, there's no entity in Washington that is looking out for the everyday person, average customers of the financial industry. We are all entangled with it. If you have a credit card, if you get direct deposit, if you want to buy a house, you are a bank customer. It's sort of unavoidable. So that's why that CFPB exists.
And it does look at every fee. That's what it. That's
part
mission.
Of what it's yeah. supposed to do. Right. It's supposed to be looking for predatory, fraudulent fees, exploitative fees. And it's interesting to note that there is a fight going on in Washington still about the existence of that bureau. There's been a lot of lobbying from the banking industry against it. There was just a sort of an appeals court decision in the last few days that issued a bit of a blow and sort of suggested that perhaps in the future a president could just fire the head of the CFPB, which would jeopardize its financial independence. But this Wells Fargo scandal has sort of played a helpful role.
Game.
Well, that's it. I mean, it's suddenly everyone's paying attention to this. Maybe we actually do need a bureau like this, because clearly this was going on a wide scale. And I think we should expect to see other stories coming out about other companies.
If the Nobel Prize for Literature winner Bob Dylan were to write a song about this, you couldn't get much more dramatic than John Stumpf's testimony when he originally went in there. Take us back to when he went in there, sort of hat in hand, looking very humble. We're trying to do the right thing. And what a bunch of malarkey.
Well, it's really, he's not looking very good right now. It's true. I mean, that testimony, he testified twice.
Yeah.
It was stunning, because I think he really believed, or one got the sense that he really expected to just go in there and say, I'm sorry, we didn't know. And just
I've got
nothing
this covered,
to see here.
Folks. That was his whole demeanor.
Move right along. Everything's fine. We're going to stay. We're going to keep our money. And, you know, it was very interesting to see Elizabeth Warren questioning him, because she was very, very blunt. And she said, you should be investigated by the Department of Justice. You should give back every penny you made while this was going on, and you should resign. And in fact, you know, after the news came out yesterday that he was stepping down, I think she issued a statement saying, OK, one out of three. What about the other two?
Statement and a T-shirt. Elizabeth Warren, those words went down in history. Sheila Kolhatkar is a staff writer at The New Yorker. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. A coalition of native tribes and environmentalists continues to try and block construction of the $3.8 billion Dakota Access Pipeline, which would carry 400,000 barrels of crude a day from production regions in North Dakota through South Dakota and Iowa before eventually reaching Illinois. Construction has resumed after a federal appeals court denied the request by the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe for an injunction to block construction. Department of Justice, Department of the Army, the Department of the Interior all petitioned for a construction stop. Protesters have vowed to remain vigilant. LaDonna Brave Bull Allard is landowner at the site of the Sacred Stone Camp, right at the epicenter of the protest.
It is very disconcerting because of the fact that they are allowing this company, this corporation, to go through village sites, ceremonial sites, burial sites of our people. I feel like they are wiping the footprint of our people off this earth, which is part of that act of genocide.
And it has been the case, certainly throughout American history, that aggressive corporations and land developers create facts on the ground that then they go back into court and say, well, we can't change it now, Judge. Do you feel like that's what's happening here?
Even as Dakota Access was asked to not work, they continued to work. The whole concept was, well, whatever the court hearing does, we can say, well, we put all this money into the work, so you have to allow us to continue. I have never worked with a corporation that violates the federal laws, state laws, environmental laws, tribal historic preservation laws. My position has always been follow the law.
You are a member of the Sioux Nation, and you're part of a coalition of Native peoples who's trying to stop this pipeline, right?
I am an enrolled member of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. I am the closest landowner here on the Standing Rock Reservation to the proposed pipeline. I live above the Cannonball River and the Missouri River, where my family is buried, where my son is buried, and I cannot allow anybody to build an environmentally destructive pipeline above my son's grave.
Was it originally these nations who would be defending this land, or are these Native peoples the result of migrations, forced migrations by the U.S. government 100 years ago?
Well, whatever, my people have been on this land for thousands and thousands, 10,000 years that I can record. And before that, because the land was underwater. I can tell you every hill, every mountaintop. I can show you where my ancestors, ancestors, ancestors are buried. I know my land. We did not come from any place else, and nor did we allow the government to move us. We are the fifth largest land-based tribe in the United States. We own 2.3 million acres and own our water rights.
What's the next step for you?
I am building a total green area so that I can teach people how to live off the land, that we can change world thought to live a better life so that we are not continually destroy the earth and the water, that we can stand up and change this before we end our own lives by destroying the water.
LaDonna Brave Bull Allard is a landowner at the site of the Sacred Stone Camp at the epicenter of the protest over the pipeline through North and South Dakota. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card, delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
The context of no context would seem to be the assignment of our next guest, Annie Carney, political reporter for Politico, who has been poring over the by now. The tally is about 6,500 WikiLeaks emails from top officials of the Hillary Clinton campaign. Julian Assange of WikiLeaks has promised 50,000 more before the election. The emails hacked from Clinton's campaign chair, John Podesta, haven't contained anything that might sink the candidate, but they do offer a look behind the scenes at the Clinton camp's calculations, their careful positioning over issues like the Keystone XL pipeline, private speeches to Wall Street firms. Annie Carney, how bleary-eyed are you about all this?
I mean, you can really get into a hole when you start reading the emails and realize that 4 hours have passed and you've been reading over all these emails. It's both troubling that these are hacked documents that were obtained from John Podesta because of criminal activities. But it's also fascinating to see how the sausage gets made, how a political campaign operates, all of the thinking that went into how to defeat Bernie Sanders in the primary.
What represents questionable, actionable, possibly behavior on the part of John Podesta?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Nothing yet. I mean, it's that we're looking at possibly 10 years of his personal email here. And I mean, it's I imagine it feels very violating to be John Podesta right now. But I mean, there's obviously no one wants their personal email read. And there's some griping about colleagues among other people. But so far, it looks like just business, what you would expect people doing business of a campaign to be doing.
What you would expect from people who have a reputation for being ruthless and competitive and have been in politics all of their life.
Yes.
So is there anything more that can come down here that is a smoking gun? Is there any sort of block of emails that are suspicious?
So far, I think the most actionable, damaging thing in there is excerpts from Hillary Clinton's paid speeches in front of Wall Street banks that she adamantly did not want made public. And the irony of it is the parts that are now public are the parts that have been flagged by her speaker's bureau as these are the parts that would be problematic if these speeches ever became public. And that's the only part that's out now.
Wow.
The flags.
So examples?
Again, there's no smoking gun, but she's talking very friendly to Wall Street bankers. You have to have a private and a public position on politically contentious issues. There's definitely things that probably could have hurt her even more in the primary against Bernie Sanders when her closeness to Wall Street and were a problem for her.
Or could hurt her now, except that we're talking about other things.
Yeah, except it's really getting overshadowed by five women who are saying that Trump groped them.
Would these be an October surprise?
First of all, I think that we're going to see potentially emails related to how they went through the vice presidential process. I'm expecting to see something related to that coming out in the next 27 days, where we see personal emails that Hillary Clinton is sending to John Podesta on here. I think that this is a huge the Clinton campaign has people solely dedicated to trying to read through all of this to see what they're having to deal with before we can read through it. So I think this is a huge distraction. If there wasn't a bigger distraction on the other side, I think this could be problematic. But again, there's no smoking gun. There's nothing here that looks like they did anything improper.
John Podesta, Darth Vader?
John Podesta's been in politics for 50 years. And it seems like either he already knew to be careful because he knew he's a high-profile operator, but he kind of seems like exactly what you would expect John Podesta to be like, a real professional. He speaks to governors and other elected officials and senators as equals. He tells them what to do. He almost communicates with Hillary Clinton like an equal in these emails. I mean, there's nothing really embarrassing for him in there so far.
And as far as the Russian connection is concerned, Trump has said, boy, wouldn't it be great to get some of those erased emails out? There's no hint of that.
From
the State Department servers.
No, but the Clinton campaign is very much trying to link the Trump campaign directly to the Russians, directly to this hack. And so far, they've pointed to Trump advisor Roger Stone as having seemed to have prior knowledge that this hack of John Podesta's emails were coming. But I don't think they've pointed to anything that absolutely ties Donald Trump's campaign to coordinating with Julian Assange and the Russians to hack it. But that's what they think happened. That's what they're trying to say.
She's a politics reporter for Politico. Annie Carney, thanks so much.
Thank you.
If I wanted to get myself in trouble, I could find any number of recording artists who have used the P word to describe the vagina, which doesn't lend itself to lyrical wordplay, unless you are Eve Ensler, the author of The Vagina Monologues. But the P word is different. Men stole it as a cover for violent rape talk, and now some women want it back.
Trump thinks he runs the town, pussy can't just shut it down. Trump thinks he runs the town, pussy can't just shut it down. Trump thinks pussy can't just shut it down.
Those are protesters outside of Trump Tower this week, and they may end up being the least of Trump's problems, as several women have gone public with detailed stories now alleging that Donald Trump groped them years ago. But regarding that P word, there is another protest taking place online a Facebook friend request between journalist Jessica Bennett and writer and performer Amanda Duarte. These women have never met in person, but they made a meme that started a movement. Amanda joins us today to discuss her part in the meme and how she feels it's empowering sexual assault survivors.
I think that Donald Trump actually is making America great again by putting this kind of explicit sexist rhetoric into the ether, into
exposing something that
yes,
you
absolutely,
is
that has been
on.
Absolutely, and it has been dog whistled, and it's been used obviously by the GOP for decades and decades and decades.
Well, the word hasn't been used by the GOP.
Oh, I mean, you know, not explicitly. No, I'm sure they're, you know, I'm sure they're using it on their own time, but they're not stupid enough to say it into a hot mic. But the word is not generally. You don't generally hear it from presidential candidates. You don't generally hear it from anybody who is at work in a professional right. capacity of any kind. So it's, yeah, it's a bit shocking. And yet I'm immensely grateful to him for putting it into the air.
And to reclaim this word, because it is a body part of yours.
It is, I do have one.
Yes. What did you do?
To reclaim this word?
Yes.
I mean, I believe very strongly in the reclamation of right. language like this. And to be honest, this word has not been a favorite of mine. I have other favorite synonyms.
In hip hop, it's kind of offensive when you hear it in hip hop.
Yes, it is. And I mean, like most words that are used in a derogatory way against oppressed groups, it is entirely within the power of the oppressed group to use that word. There are many examples that we're not going to say on the air, but the member of the oppressed group is allowed to use the word. The oppressor is not allowed to use the word. So I can use that word all I want. And, you know, in hip hop or whatever, they can use the N-word as much as they want. But it's our word now, you know. So to be honest, it's not been my favorite vaginal synonym, but I decided on Friday to snatch it back, if you will, and make it a word of empowerment.
Oh, how'd you do that?
I did is I post a lot on social media and I have like a reasonable size following. And so when I heard these words coming out of a presidential candidate's mouth, like many women in America who have been assaulted, who have heard this kind of sexist, disgusting rhetoric coming from men our entire lives, I was, as they say, triggered, and I could actually feel it in my body. I could actually feel if vaginal nausea were – I wish there were a word for that. If vaginal nausea is a thing, and I think mm-hmm. the ladies who are listening can understand what I'm talking about, I felt it very deeply in my body. And so I decided to turn it around. And, you know, as women, we are conditioned to believe that we have no power. And yet in that moment, I felt flooded with this immense power because we have immense power. We're going to determine the outcome of the most important election in modern history.
But I do think that suddenly this election is about the dehumanization of sexuality, the turning of sexuality into artifacts, into objects.
Yes.
And tell me how that works for you.
Well, I mean, we as women, we feel this way all the time. You know, it's something we're so accustomed to. Our bodies are talked about as if they're objects. We're treated as if we're objects. And we're threatened with rape constantly. On my way here to record this with you, I was followed from the bodega when I got coffee into the subway station with a man, you know, threatening to rape me. This happened to me on the way here. It happens to us every single day.
What do you make of the people who are alleging he groped them?
I guess I don't understand the question. What do I make of them? Like, do I believe them?
Of course they must have done. Does it change the situation at all?
I believe them.
Totally.
He bragged openly into a hot mic mm-hmm. about using his fame and power to sexually assault women and get away with it. Why wouldn't we believe him? You know, he says he tells it like it is. He says he's, you know, so honest. Why wouldn't we believe him? And why wouldn't we believe all these women who are coming forward?
So either America is a place that is like really macho and actually doesn't care about all of this, as you've kind of suggested, and Trump should get elected, or America is a changing place and rejects this wholeheartedly and is utterly disgusted and Trump should, like, leave the country. What's going to happen?
I mean, we're going to find out, right? I absolutely believe that this is a turning point, that this is, you know, a tipping point, and that Trump, unfortunately, I don't think he's going to leave. He's absolutely not going to be elected president of the United States. I don't think
When did you believe that?
When? Pretty early on. Then I had some fears, and now I'm, you know, if Donald Trump is elected.
Friday did it for you.
Oh, Friday for sure. I mean, before Friday, but Friday, absolutely.
Your meme again?
November 8th, Pussy Grabs Back.
Amanda Duarte, writer and performer, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
Google's new subsidiary, Jigsaw, has begun to pilot a set of tools called Conversation AI, designed to use machine learning to deeply track speech patterns that might indicate casual talk about racial hatred, sexual violence, crime, genocide, and automatically spot and moderate hate speech online more accurately and efficiently than humans ever could. They've already partnered with the New York Times to moderate comment sections. But Google's attempts to censor online harassment, a whole new set of code words are being used to identify religious and ethnic groups. Google is the N-word, Skype for Jew, Skittles means gay men, Aleppo is a code for libertarian. Whitney Phillips is an assistant professor at Mercer University and author of This Is Why We Can't Have Nice Things, Mapping the Relationship Between Online Trolling and Mainstream Culture.
Right now, it's not entirely clear what the full applicability of the algorithm is going to be. The New York Times will be using it to moderate comments, and Wikimedia is going to be implementing it somehow, but they're not entirely sure at this point. So it's not fully clear to what extent this is actually going to impact people's daily online lives. It has some potential, of course, but the AI needs to learn a bit more before it rolls out.
And if we're talking about filtering inappropriate comments on a site like the New York Times, this is going to have to be way more sophisticated than just, you know, searching for bad words.
Yeah, I mean, well, the complication with this sort of algorithm is that it is looking for certain words, certain phrases, and may not be able to pick up on the full nuance of communicative exchanges, that it may not be able to distinguish between, you know, humor and satire and more sincere extremism. But on the other hand, that's a distinction that human beings actually struggle to make as well. So that's not going to be just a problem specific to the algorithm, but it's often really difficult to tell when something is meant seriously and when it's meant, you know, to rile people up or to criticize or sort of undermine a bigoted position. So humans have some issues with this discernment as well.
But they have issues with it online. They don't have issues with it in terms of the way we operate in social communities. I mean, I'm wondering if this, instead of being artificial intelligence, is actually artificial stupidity, in the sense that Google could maybe develop an algorithm that would do more of a shaming mechanism for people who speak inappropriately, bring them out, you know, operate in the more natural constraints that we use to regulate hate speech rather than just filtering something out in a mechanistic kind of way.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, the thing about the conversation AI is that right now it's still at its earliest phases, that it was just announced. But one of the things that the Jigsaw people have been talking about is that down the road it may end up being an open source kind of a tool, and then communities would be able to implement it in ways that made sense for that community. For some communities, simple word filtering might be all that's needed, and other communities, depending on what sort of community it is and what the stakes of the conversation might be, they would potentially be able to implement it in ways that were more appropriate and more organic to the way that communities sort of police their own boundaries in embodied spaces and in online spaces as well. When community formation works, everybody is on the same page in terms of the rules. So depending, you know, down the road how the software or how the algorithm is developed, it could be that that is how it's used.
What this looks like to me is, you know, the New York Times wants to erase graffiti from its page, you know, and they're using a very sophisticated tool to essentially scrub their comments wall. But you've got to figure that this has implications in, like, national security and a whole other bunch of places.
Well, I mean, it could potentially, absolutely, yeah. I mean, every major platform, including news organizations, they're all having to contend with really problematic speech and behavior that goes beyond just simple bad words. This is not, you know, the problem is not just people saying four-letter words. It has to do with sort of deeper sort of cultural issues around racism and homophobia. The internet is rife with speech and behavior that isn't just annoying and isn't just sort of ugly, but can be outright dangerous. And so then the question is, what can be done? But more importantly and more vexingly, what should be done? What's the responsibility of these platforms to moderate spaces so that their users feel like they can participate in a way that's meaningful to them?
But if Serena Williams, for instance, wanted to have something like this personally to keep speech regarding her internet presence from referencing her race and making comments that we've seen have actually been in her experience, this would be more appropriate for people to have as a personal tool rather than some corporate filter, which makes me a little bit nervous, quite frankly.
Yeah, I mean, I can't really speak to whether or not that'll ultimately be how it ends up playing out. But I do think that individuals who experience a disproportionate amount of hate and harassment, especially around race and gender and sexual orientation, individuals who are constantly dealing with a barrage of hate. You know, most recently what happened with Leslie Jones, the harassment that she had to navigate. The way that we've been doing it up till this point certainly has not, you know, stymied too much of this abuse. So what technological tools are potentially available that might make things a little bit easier for people to navigate online spaces so that they can feel like they can participate in ways that are meaningful to them?
Are comments pages a benchmark for free speech in the 21st century, do you think, or are they something of a fringe activity?
It depends on the platform. Sometimes comments are mostly supplementary. It's not actually a community. It's more just a bulletin board type of a situation. But many platforms are, their entire community hinges on the ability to comment. And so how important comment spaces are really depends on the community and what exactly is being discussed. I mean, I think that issues of free speech are only going to continue to get more and more messy. They're recognizing the problem and are taking some steps, at least, towards coming to some kind of a solution.
Speaking to us from Macon, Georgia, Whitney Phillips is assistant professor at Mercer University and author of This Is Why We Can't Have Nice Things, Mapping the Relationship Between Online Trolling and Mainstream Culture. Whitney, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And before we leave you today, to some it was a surprise to hear from Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. In an interview with Katie Couric on Yahoo News earlier this week, the justice called NFL player Colin Kaepernick's and his sympathetic colleagues' protests during the national anthem dumb.
I think it's really dumb of them. Would I arrest them for doing it? No. I think it's dumb and disrespectful. I would have the same answer if you asked me about flag burning. I said, I think it's a terrible thing to do, but I wouldn't lock a person up for doing it.
In response, Colin Kaepernick said, it is disappointing to hear a Supreme Court justice call a protest against injustice and oppression stupid, dumb, in reference to players doing that. On our Facebook page, there's a lot of you talking about this. Scott writes on Facebook, I'm sympathetic to Kaepernick and Black Lives Matter concerns, but I don't think his protest moves the needle for anyone. This is not a new issue, and I doubt Cap will change many minds. Given that, I think that his protest is disrespectful without gaining much, and so I side with the notorious RBG. Kathleen writes on Facebook, I was disappointed in her comments and surprised she couldn't see that she's speaking through the eyes of extreme white privilege and should be open to learning something here. Keep the conversation going. We're on Facebook at The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PR. PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.